imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love and hold her tight. So happy to get.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with the whole MERS editorial staff, the boss John Roering, Jake Kanzler, Lisa Church, Jack Spencer, and Mike Malott, and our special guest sitting in today, Josh Pugh for Our Future Michigan. Look at that, representing. He's got it embroidered on his zip-up here and everything.
That way you wouldn't forget.
That's good. You know me very well, don't you? Also, hopefully, Lucky the Puppy doesn't start barking at some point during this podcast.
We've got to get some embroidered stuff, man. Some MERS shirts like that. That's really cool.
Well, I've got
a stick in town. I really want one.
I know.
You think we can do a zip-up kind of something like
probably,
that?
Probably, yeah. I'll work on that.
All right. We'll put it on the list. And then, because, you know, everybody's going to want one.
Maybe we could sell them on the website, make a lot of extra money.
Oh, I'm sure. Lots.
Lots.
Support your local MERS reporter. Buy some logoed gear.
Buy some swag. MERS swag. A few things that we want to get to before we go to our conversation with Lee Chatfield, the new Speaker of the House. One of the big items of news last week was Bridget McCormick is the new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Lisa, you weren't surprised by this.
No.
Why weren't you surprised? Lisa, our courts reporter.
She just seems to be a voice that the others listen to. They won't let me peek behind closed doors, so I don't actually know that for a fact. I just, from observing them, she seems to be someone that the others listen to.
John, you remember what this court was like before Bridget McCormick.
It was an emotional hot mess.
It was an emotional hot mess, wasn't it? And then Bridget McCormick came, and something happened with this court.
I kind of wonder, and I don't know this because, like you said, we don't get to watch their behind-the-scenes deliberations, but it kind of leads you to wonder whether or not she's sort of the emotional balm to the wound that was the court prior to her coming there. Because it seemed like Bob Young couldn't say enough nice things about her. I think she kind of changed the personality of the court. Maybe she changed the rancor or lessened the rancor when they have deliberations and kind of became the personality of the court, if you will.
I remember she kind of formed a bond with Mary Beth Kelly, who was on the Supreme Court for a couple years, and combined, and then Bob Young really took to her because she seemed to listen to all sides and made it more of a deliberative body. What's been your impression of her on this court, Josh?
Yeah, I think the reason that she has really, and I mean the entire Supreme Court at this point has really befuddled a lot of people in this town, is because Bridget is not someone who's a politician. She's more of a technician. I think that if you just look at, to Lisa's point about us not being able to sit in on the deliberations or get behind closed doors. But, I mean, if you just look at social media, the entire court would go out for dinner. And that started happening several years ago, even before any of this became more substantive. I mean, she's really someone who is really interested in getting into the nitty-gritty of how the court works, the bureaucracy, and also, like, really taking seriously, the obligation of the court to be responsive and be accountable to the people it serves. I mean, you've seen them over the past few months going out and into the field and having hearings, you know, out in towns other than this one, which I think is something that maybe other branches of government could be improved from as well.
You know, one of the things that I was looking at when they were going to be deciding the Supreme Court Chief Justice, and there was, for me, it really came down to one of two. I mean, it was either going to be Stephen Markman for another term, or it was going to be Bridget McCormick. And you could say, oh, yeah, Kyle, you're just saying that. But if you look at the majority, Jacob, of the decisions and where they came down, you didn't see 5-2 decisions very often from this Supreme Court.
Yeah, I did a story last year after the big cases, the redistricting case and the gun case, and I went and looked at that story, and I think we only found one time where the justices voted clear cut on the party line 5-2. I think with Justice McCormick becoming the Chief Justice, I think you're going to even get even more unpredictable now. I mean, you have that block that voted together on those controversial cases, McCormick, Viviano, Clement, and Bernstein. But I think you're going to see something like that because, you know, Republicans are still 4-3 majority technically. But I think with the justices on the court right now, you're going to get it's going to be harder to predict even on the controversial cases where you're suspected that the one side's going to fall on one side and the other on the other.
You take a look at what the majority was this past term, and it was not Republican-Democrat. It was Bridget McCormick, David Viviano, Richard Bernstein, and Beth Clement. That was the majority, Lisa. That was the working majority. So it shouldn't really be any surprise that the more senior member of that kind of quadrant would be the Chief Justice.
That makes sense. Besides, if you ask them, they don't make their decisions based on I'm Republican or Democrat, if you ask them.
Right.
They don't pay any attention to that. We do, but they supposedly don't. I mean, that's what they'd argue.
So this working majority now that they have in the Supreme Court, John, they can't really make Republicans very happy.
No, and I get the sense from talking to some folks around town that there are some associations who spent a lot of money trying to create a law and order court, investing in the campaigns, and they spent a lot of times over a lot of years, and I think it's kind of slid away from them.
I mean, the real only law and order caucus that they have in that court right now is Brian Zara and at times Stephen Markman. What's your perception on this, Jay?
Well, I think they've gotten a bad rap in the past even for, I'm not so sure the Supreme Court has, even going back several years, been nearly as much a court that makes as many political decisions as they've been accused of. My mind goes back to the Paul Scott case. If people remember that one, everybody in town expected them to let the Paul Scott recall go all the way into February, which is what the Republicans wanted him to do, in which case he would not have been recalled. And they just poured cold water on that. And that was a completely, you know, Republican-controlled court. I think they've had more there's a difference between saying this is good for the party, so I'm going to vote for it, and having a philosophical point of view that's conservative.
Right.
I think the arguments that I've heard is that the philosophical nature of the court has changed, that they're less prone to be strict constructionists than I think people had originally hoped.
Yeah, that may be the case, because I just think that you see them make clearly a bipartisan decision like this one as to who's going to be the Chief Justice, and I think it sends a signal. I don't know if it's going to actually change what they do or compared to what they would have done anyway, but it certainly sends a signal.
Wasn't it interesting, Josh, when we took a look at Beth Clement getting sworn in on January 1 and who swore her into office? I think that was kind of a precursor as to what we could expect with this Chief Justice.
Yeah, two things. I would say that it's interesting because Republicans always say that they want judges who are going to call balls and strikes and not be partisan, and now they've got a majority that's going to do that. And according to John, they're not very happy about that, so I don't know what to think about that, but... The other thing is I really think that the Michigan Republican Party sort of made their bet here. With if you could look back at that convention and thumb in their nose at Beth Clement, they delivered themselves this majority as much as anybody else. Obviously, the win of Justice Kavanaugh was huge and historic for Democrats as well.
Why is that? Why did you say huge and historic?
Oh, Wenzel, I mean, because you don't have on the ballot, you don't have a Republican or Democratic distinction that would typically drive that. You just have justice of the Supreme Court. So the idea that one of those would lose, a candidate who doesn't have that designation on the ballot would win, that's something that hasn't happened in several cycles.
How much did that have to do with the national thing with the name Kavanaugh? Did that fool lots of Republicans around the state? Has there been any evidence of that?
I have not seen any evidence of that. I will tell you that certainly behind the scenes with everything else going on, it sort of had to be behind the scenes. There was a concentrated effort. We don't have the voter file, so we're still digging into the effects of what actually happened at this point, and because we don't know, because we haven't seen who actually voted and how that interacts with the work that we were doing. But I will tell you, between the Michigan Association of Justice and the campaign itself and some other outside groups, there was a real concentrated effort, and what we saw in the polling was ultimately reflected on Election Day.
Well, we can definitely say that this court is a lot different than the Cliff Taylor, Elizabeth Weaver courts of the past, where there were some pretty hot decisions, and the court made the New York Times for its dysfunction.
Yep, some great dissents.
Oh, they were great to read, but it was pretty embarrassing to see headlines in the New York Times about how dysfunctional our Supreme Court was and what a 180-degree turn it seems to have made toward a bipartisan coalition that we're seeing right now. Okay, so we've seen that the Supreme Court now has taken a more bipartisan approach. Now, how about the State House? Lee Chatfield, the Speaker of the House, was talking a lot about a more bipartisan, reaching across the aisle, working together type attitude. And the first press conference, right out of the bat, Mike, on the House floor, who does he bring in but Dana Nessel? What was your impression of this first move?
He really wants to give a note of bipartisanship. He said all the right things. He also said in his remarks that Whitmer's success is Michigan's success. He's certainly making all the right sounds. And I think I had a conversation with him, we'll hear later, on no fault. He seems open to a lot more negotiation and amendment than I think we saw last year. So I think he's trying to set the tone that it will be bipartisan.
You think this is a generational thing? I mean, he's a pretty young speaker. And it seems to me in my conversations with younger Republicans, actually younger period, they're a little more frustrated, I think, with the partisanship than people maybe, Kyle, our age. You know, we're getting old.
No, we are not. I don't know. What do you think of that, Mike?
I kind of take it as reading the tea leaves from the last election. There was a lot of feedback, blowback to what's happening at the national level, and I read it more that way.
Josh, you're nodding your head over there.
Yeah, I think what's happened at the state level, too. I mean, really, it's been, for those who tune into state politics, it's been new lows of pessimism every day, but not just with lame duck most recently, but I mean, this is a Republican legislature that over the past few sessions has been incredibly partisan. Of course, in any midterm, you know, there's going to be a reaction to whoever the president is. But really, I think there was a lot of anger and frustration with the state leadership, too. And you saw that not just in how Gretchen campaigned and the success that she had in calling on us to just fix the damn roads already, but really a historic sweep of the trifecta for Democrats that we haven't seen since the 1930s.
There's one thing I want to mention, and maybe Josh mentioned this a little bit, but there was something that Senator Ananick said last week talking about how people should not forget what happened during lame duck. And that kind of contrasts a lot with this talk of bipartisanship. And so I'm wondering how long, you know, if those feelings are going to fester, especially with folks that were around for lame duck and have now moved into a different spot.
But if you're going to hold on to that, you're holding on to something that so many members of the legislature who aren't even there anymore did. It's like, I mean, if you're going to hold on to that, you're promising yourself dysfunction, period. I mean, think about how many members of the Senate are gone. Think how much the House has changed from just, you know, 2 weeks ago. I don't know why you'd hold on to that anger.
As part of a fun exercise that we did earlier here at MERS, we took a look at the House and the Senate from the 2013-14 session to the current House of 2019-2020. And based on past voting records, and clearly with the new people, you can't necessarily say what kind of voting record they would have, but based on what information we have, we took a look at was the 13-14 legislature, the last term of Jace Bolger, more conservative, or this new House and Senate from 2019-2020. And in the House, what we discerned was in 15 cases, the 15 House members were more conservative than who we have now in office. And in 9 cases, the people who are currently serving is more conservative than the people they replaced. So just from taking a look at that, it's 15-9, so maybe marginally more conservative back in 2013-14. And then in the Senate, it was kind of the same thing, marginally more conservative back in 2014 than it would be going forward. 5 more conservative in 14, and 3 more conservative now, with a lot of pushes in there. And, you know, you don't really know until you get going. But the point is that this House and this Senate is not starting off more conservative than those past. One would look at past voting records and how they have done and conclude that this should be a bit more of a moderate Republican majority.
Well, I'll tell you. How about looking back and comparing it to the last time we had a Democratic governor? The 2008 legislature. The world has changed so much. Do you remember that there were actually pro-life Democrats in that legislature in 2008? I mean, this is almost a completely different world right now in just 10 years ago.
My point being that bipartisanship may be easier to come by this term than if we would have had a Democratic governor, let's say, in 2014. Let's say Mark Schauer had won. Josh, what do you think of that?
Well, look, I think that what a lot of this discussion is being based on right now is that opening press conference. And I think that was a wonderful gambit for both sides. It was attention getting. Craig Mauger and I were sitting around trying to predict what it was going to be the night before, and we thought FOIA reform. Honestly, I don't think they could have found a piece of fruit that was any more low-hanging than civil asset forfeiture. But, you know, it's an important piece of criminal justice reform. I hope it gets done finally. I hope the Senate doesn't stand in their way. But I think reading into that as evidence that we're going to usher in some new era of bipartisanship is a little half-cocked.
For the House's benefit, all right, and you can take a look at Lee Chatfield and Frank Foster, okay, and we put that into the calculation. Who is more conservative, Lee Chatfield or the person he replaced, Frank Foster? And we all agree it's got to be Lee Chatfield, right? But it's Lee Chatfield who's talking bipartisanship. And so that gets to the point that you had mentioned, Mike. Mike, is this more political expediency? Does he have to do this because it's politically important for him to do so? Or is it because of some deep-seated bipartisanship? And I might argue this is because it has to happen politically. And I think your interview with him and your question about what should be done with constitutional carry speaks to that point. And talk about that.
Bo LaFave has reintroduced constitutional carry, and I raised this
What's constitutional carry?
You wouldn't need a CPL to carry concealed. You could actually carry your weapon and conceal it without a license. What the CPL gets you is the ability to take your gun into what is currently considered a gun-free zone.
And so what did Lee Chatfield say about that?
He said he agrees with it, he voted for it, he's going to stand by that vote, he'll vote for it again, but something to the effect of, nobody would see me as crazy if I said that Whitmer was unlikely to sign that.
So basically, why push something that isn't going to go to the finish line anyway? What's the point?
Right. Well, both he and LaFave said they'd have a conversation with Whitmer about it, but again, why push the point?
Which is an interesting tactic if you consider sort of the tendency we've had to sort of make these symbolic votes to prove our conservative bona fides that we've had over the years.
And that goes to the next point. If Republicans are going to keep the House in 2020, Jack, with Donald Trump presumably at the top of the ticket, what are they going to have to do?
Well, I look at it a lot different. Why do this if the governor isn't going to sign it? My little word that I put in there is, why do this now if the governor is going to not sign it? Okay. Why not wait till we're closer to our next elections, which, by the way, are all primaries?
Okay, so you're saying that come primary season, we may see this bill.
You have it now. Now, it can be arranged so that somehow or the other it never even gets to the governor, but it's getting those votes recorded by the people who are running in the districts where it's going to be helpful to them.
Josh, so my point is that does the House want to take up these issues that they've taken up the last 8 years when it was advantageous and they knew that the Republicans were going to win, or are they going to want to push these in the back burner because come 2020, do you want to give more ammunition to folks in Oakland County to not vote Republican and not vote for Donald Trump?
That's a really good point, Kyle. I mean, there's obviously, as John was alluding to, I'm sure there's going to be a desire in parts of that Republican caucus to push through those votes anyway, make or veto it, get that on a record, whether it be constitutional carry or any number of other issues that they know are going to be non-starters. However, sure, you might say that a dozen or two dozen members of the House caucus want those votes for their primaries, but does Ryan Berman really want to take that vote in Oakland County and be accountable for that to a general election electorate at the end of the day in November?
No, he doesn't.
Do to-be-determined candidates in suburban Kalamazoo County and in suburban Oakland County and Mike Weber's seat in Rochester Hills, do they want to answer questions about those votes at forums in October 2020? And so I think just because it's smaller and because they lost the number of moderate swing seats that they did, this caucus probably on balance is more conservative than in the last legislative session and past legislative sessions. But is Chatfield going to be boxed in by not only the fact that he's got to work with the governor, but he's got some members who maybe don't want to take those votes?
My way of looking at that is to do those people want to take that vote or not? That's why I would think you wait until you get right down to finding out whether those people are going to have competition in their primaries.
And your argument is that if they're going to have competition, if they're going to get primaried, they're going to want something to go back to their constituency.
Why waste a good primary election vote early when you don't even know who's going to have competition or not? That's just the way my...
So you would be surprised if they do anything with constitutional carry this year, but come exactly 365 days from now or next April, things could change a little
bit. Yeah, unless there's a calculation I'm missing there, I would think if you have people that would have a problem with it, you arrange it so that it's... You take the vote if you're going to take it at the most opportune time when you actually know what the situation is going to be in the future. I think generally with a bipartisanship thing, it's a wonderful posturing. I mean, why on earth shouldn't you posture on the all bipartisan stuff? I mean, it would be crazy not to. And I also will tell you, I would not be a bit surprised if it carried over to them doing some... where they can do bipartisanship, I would not be surprised to see it carry over to them actually finding some ways to do some of that stuff earlier. I noticed with Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick's four items he came out with for the statement for the Democrats on that side, there were a couple of those four, if you actually looked at it, that they might actually be workable if they were conducted the right way. As far as clawbacks, I'm not so sure that's totally against the way conservatives look at things, having clawbacks for the
MEDC
MEDC type stuff. And I wonder what happens or what they do with the child credit, too, tax credit thing. I don't know if that's terribly horrible if you found the right way to do it. So if you can find ways to get some bipartisanship early, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. I'm not holding my breath on it lasting too long.
All right, so a tax credit for working men and women, that's a possibility. For some reason, it seems like bipartisanship in the legislature, unlike the Supreme Court, falls apart at some point.
And you probably will get, too, you'll probably get bipartisan cooperation on sort of the restoration of the special tax treatment for state and local government retirees, that so-called restoration of the exemption.
The buzzword.
Tax, John. The pension tax.
See, Josh likes to call it the pension tax. Well, John's got a better name for it.
Well, originally it was just a small exemption that was originally put in place to the income tax that was for just state and local government employees. And we seem to forget to mention the fact that it's only state and public employees that are going to benefit from this change. I mean, if you want to have a retirement pension tax relief, then you should do it across the board for the entire economy.
I think that was Mike Shirky's point that he made. If we were going to start exempting some type of retirement income, we'll then do that. But to make it just specific to government employees in a certain age bracket, does that really work or not? And Chris Cobe, the state budget director, kind of Jacob, it sounds like, was during the budget or the consensus revenue estimating conference when asked about what kind of impact that's going to have, mentioned that's going to have a budgetary impact. And is that something they're going to want to tackle right away?
Yeah, I mean, he acknowledged that, if you take that away, absent any other moves, that would be, detrimental. But, he's not, he kind of answered it with the budget director hat on, but I don't think he necessarily gave away, Whitmer administration support for wanting to repeal the so-called pension tax.
You got to remember also that when you have some of these ideas that come out, it's one thing when it's the Snyder administration working about budgetary impact. That's a much more nuanced situation. It won't be as nuanced this time if it ends up being the Whitmer administration.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's a lot easier for the Republicans to holler and scream and just pass things anyway.
But to say that this is going to have a budgetary impact?
Yeah, it's a lot easier to handle that when you have a Democratic administration maybe doing the exact same kinds of things that the Snyder administration would have done, but it's a lot easier to just, to stand up and
You're talking about playing politics. We're playing politics.
So fiscal impact is easier to call when the governorship's controlled by the opposite party?
Oh, yeah, it's much easier. It's a lot easier to stand up and do this or do that or say, by gosh, it's about time we got this thing done, et cetera, et cetera, when, first of all, it's not going to have the impact because it's going to be vetoed. But you can do it more publicly when the governor is of the other party.
All right, guys. Well, let's tune in now to Mike's conversation with Lee Chapman and some of the questions that he had for this new speaker.
Me and you and me, no matter how they toss the dice, it had to be the only one for me is you and you for me.
so happy together.
About the committees, have you taken any steps to make sure that they don't become a bottleneck?
The intention is not for these to be a bottleneck, and many could argue that the past structure of the committees was also to be a bottleneck. And that argument can be made for whether you have a dual review process or a triple review process, and many have even accused the House floor of being a bottleneck. The purpose of this is to make sure bills are properly vetted. And if the additional vetting leads to fewer bills on the floor, then that is up to the purview of the chair and what he considers to be a good bill. But I think it's important in an era of term limits that we give bills a stronger look. None of us have been serving in this chamber for 20 years, and we need to ensure we know what we're doing before we're changing state law.
Another thing that you're doing is the policy action plan that you've put in place. You put Miller as the chair of that. What is it that you're hoping to accomplish there?
Well, every year when we get together, the caucus gets together and we start forming what our priorities are. And it's important that we put our heads together and we rely on the differences that we have with one another. We rely on the different experiences that people have coming from different regions of the state. And we form an action plan that we believe will move our entire state together. You know, over the last couple of months, I've had the opportunity to speak with the press about what my priorities are, but I'm not a dictator of the caucus and I'm not a dictator of the chamber. This is something that we all need to put our heads together. And I'm optimistic that we can put together a good action plan that we think can continue moving the state in the right direction. We've taken many strides over the last 8 years, and everyone can feel it and see it because it's all around us. But we have to answer the question, what can we continue to do to move us in the right direction? And I think that's what the action plan will be.
So what's the status of that at this point?
We're continuing to form our ideas, and our caucus hasn't been together for too long, and we want to make sure that whatever product we release is thoroughly vetted.
Will you release that publicly?
Absolutely. Okay. The purpose of that is to release it so the state knows what our priorities are, and ultimately that we can be held accountable to the goals that we set early on in the term.
And so what kind of a document do you envision this being? Is it going to be like a bullet point of your priorities?
I think the document will be similar to what we've seen in previous terms, whether it's bullet points or whether it's categories, but it'll just be a detailed plan of what we hope to accomplish.
Does it affect you that Governor Whitmer delayed her state of the state in terms of forming?
No, I think that's customary for governors who are coming in their first year, and it was something that I had anticipated early on. And I anticipate that she will have all her ducks lined in a row by the time February 5th comes around, and I'm happy to have her in the House chamber. And I know myself, as well as all my colleagues, are very eager to hear what her plan is for the state.
Do you feel the need to talk to her, have one of your quadrant meetings that have been talked about before you issue the policy plan, or do you think that your caucus's policy plan should be independent?
Well, we certainly have separation of powers, and I do believe that our caucus action plan needs to reflect what we as a caucus want to tackle. But at the same time, I am actively staying in communication with the governor, and I know we will have several meetings before her state of the state, and those are meetings that I'm looking forward to, and I think that can be productive. But when we're issuing our caucus action plan, it is the action plan of the Republican House caucus and no one else.
You laid out some of your priorities yesterday in your remarks just after your election. No Fault you named as the most important item for moving the state forward. Last year when the bill went through, it was my impression that Speaker Leonard and Representative Tice were not very flexible. You may disagree with me, but I didn't think that they were too open to amendments. As you address No Fault, will you be looking for changes? Will you be open to amendments?
First, I do believe it'd be an unfair characterization to say that the speaker or the bill sponsor was not open to amendments. I think it was much different than what it would have been had either of them drawn it up themselves. But I think when we're talking about No Fault, I sincerely believe it's the single largest issue that's facing our state. I think it's saddling our residents with burdensome cost. And I think all stakeholders need to be at the table and willing to compromise in order to get this done. The fact is, here we are 20 years in the making, continuing to debate No Fault. So the fact is that compromises have not been made, and that is a problem that is costing our taxpayers and our families. We need to come to the table. We need to have a serious conversation. That's what I intend on doing. I intend on working with the Senate and working with the administration to ensure that we can get it done.
Does the package have to include PIP choice? to be a reform?
I mean, I'm certainly not going to say before we have our committee that the package has to include one aspect or another. What I do believe is that the conversation needs to include everyone at the table, and that's what I'm committed to doing.
In your remarks, you talked about making sure that we do not over-criminalize our citizens. Can you explain what that means?
Part of it can be described in what we're doing in our first package of bills with civil asset forfeiture. I do believe there's many aspects of our criminal justice system that are outdated, and I'm going to be working with the Judiciary Committee. I'll also be working with our Attorney General to ensure that we're looking at our criminal justice system and finding ways that it can be updated. And I believe yesterday's bill package is a good first step in that. We brought multiple people to the table. We reached across the aisle. We have a bipartisan bill package to take steps towards that. And Michigan has a long way to go, and I'm continuing to have those conversations with the experts in the room to ensure that we can make it better.
Are there other aspects of criminal justice reform that you have in mind?
I think you will see with our action plan that comes out some aspects touching on criminal justice reform. And some of those conversations are taking place right now that might be reflected in our action plan.
Beau LeFave was just talking to me about some bills that he's introduced regarding concealed carry. He calls it constitutional carry. Mm-hmm. Is it your feeling that there needs to be some further reform on concealed carry law?
Sure. Well, I'm already on the record for voting for it last term, and I will stand by that vote. And I do believe in his characterization of calling it constitutional carry, because whether we're talking about the federal constitution or the state constitution, people have a right to keep and bear arms. And that's a fundamental right that's been acknowledged within our constitution since its birth. However, at the same time, we're going to not only focus on issues like that, but issues I believe we can get across the finish line. I don't think anyone would call me crazy if I said I don't believe Governor Whitmer would be inclined to sign that. However, if it's something that we can get through the chamber, I will have that conversation with her.
Now, we're looking at experience levels of the incoming representatives, and by our reading of biographies, we are seeing that 29 of the new members appear to have no elective office experience. What's your feelings about that, and how do you intend to address that?
Sounds like we need a dual review process of committees.
Okay, you've already addressed it. Does it concern you that so many people are coming to the legislature? It seems to me that most people should be starting at the lower levels, and there is value in learning.
There's a clear delineation between local units of government and state government. And whoever's coming in, it's going to be the person that their district sent that they believe can best reflect their values, their principles, and their ideas. We certainly have a citizen-led legislature because people are coming in with no experience in the past, much like myself 4 years ago. And this process is one that you must commit yourself to. And you must commit to learning the best you can, learning from people who have come before you, learning from people maybe even in different stakeholders around the city. And that was part of the reason, even yesterday, I brought in some former speakers of the House, because I wanted to learn what their experiences are. And many people, including myself, don't know what we don't know. And we have to be willing to listen and learn to those who have come before us. I have every doubt that my colleagues that I'm serving with now and the representatives that are entering the legislature will do just that.
Okay. 51 members of the legislature now are women. Mm-hmm. What's your feeling about that?
I think it's great. I think whether it's a man or a woman, whoever the district believes can best represent their values, they should send. I don't tend to look at things through a gender lens. I truly don't. I think the district should send, whether it's a man or a woman, whoever they think is in the best interest to represent them. I know the House Republican caucus grew in women, as did the House Democrat caucus. And I think it's great. I think men and women need to come together and do the best we can to improve our state.
Still not reflective of the overall population. You know, if it went by population, it would be 50-50, and it's not that. Is there anything that the legislature should be doing to encourage?
I think that would be up to the people in the district. Though I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, I would venture to say that women win their races on a higher percentage than men do, so it wouldn't be that they're not being elected. It could potentially be that they're not running for office as much as men. But that is something that needs to be dealt with by the people, not by the legislature. I think it'd be overstepping our bounds to go in and tell them who needs to run for office and why.
Past Senate Majority Leader Meekoff had some harsh things to say about the House at the tail end of lame duck. He said the House had been dysfunctional due to inexperience. Do you want to respond to that?
I won't respond specifically to the comment, but what I will respond to is that the House and the Senate had a good partnership over the last couple of years, and if you look at our track record, we passed many reforms, and we got many good things done, and we ended up working with Governor Snyder. It might not have always been pretty at times, we might not always have agreed throughout the process, but the final product was something that we delivered on, and it is the 2 years that I'm very proud to have served under Speaker Leonard.
What's your relationship like with Mike Shirkey?
Yeah, I think he's a great guy. I think he's someone who's got experience in the private sector. He's got experience in state government. And I think he's a man of character, and he's someone that I know I can work with. He's someone I know I can negotiate with. And he's a straight shooter. He's always going to tell me the truth. And I've had the opportunity to build a very healthy relationship with him over the last couple of years. And I think he's a fair and decent man, and I'm looking forward to the next couple of years.
Is there any thoughts as to grooming the next speaker? Are you looking for somebody who...
Yeah, that's a decision to be made by the next caucus. The only grooming, hopefully, that will be done is just to ensure that it's another Republican. But other than that, that's something that the next caucus will, that's the next caucus's decision and certainly not mine. But gee, I had hoped I wouldn't have to answer a question about the next speaker, at least until my second interview with you guys. You guys had to jam me with it on the first one. Show us how quick things move around here.
I assume we're running out of time. Do I have time for one more? After that lame duck session, Representative Howell had a joint resolution that would basically end session just before the election, basically banning lame duck. Given the lame duck that we had, would you favor or oppose that resolution, which Representative Howell says he's going to bring back?
Well, much like many of the representatives who were serving last term, I needed several days to catch up on sleep after that lame duck, and things certainly moved at a back-breaking speed. I do believe that people need to serve for the term that they were elected. And every single term, when you get elected in November, you are to serve for 2 years. And your term will go throughout those 2 years. So I think it's a far greater constitutional discussion rather than one that can be solved simply through legislation.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of BRRRS Monday. Thanks to Lisa Church and John Jacob, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and Josh Pugh for our future. And thanks again for wearing the zip-up so I know exactly what group you're from. And also thanks to the lucky puppy for not going bananas at some passing dog, cat, or the mailman, even though the mailman has already come and gone, and he's already gone.
Here at MERS, we always have dogs and cats that are running around. It's just part of the atmosphere.
Well, it's just like the legislature. There's always dogs and cats.
We haven't had a cat yet, though, have we?
No.
But that could happen. We could have a MERS cat. We've got a MERS cat who roams around outside, finds mice and stuff.
It's not as big of an issue as it was when we first moved into this building, because you remember, you weren't here. You remember this, though. The windows in this building were in the basement were so bad that we got mice all the time. So we replaced the windows with those glass blocks and cemented everything in. And it's been a lot better. So we don't really need cats.
Well, yeah, I kind of noted when I said dogs and cats, you didn't look super enthused. So,
did you suggest, John, it would be cheaper just to get a MERS cat downstairs to take care of the mice problem?
No, I'm so oblivious that I didn't notice. Yeah, mice could be up there eating my lunch on the desk, and I probably wouldn't notice it.
I don't know if that's a good attribute or not.
I won't comment on what used to fall out of Jack's keyboards when I had to clean it.
Oh, when we tip those big keyboards over. Oh my God, you have a lunch right there with all the crumbs and stuff that come out of that.
Broccoli. Broccoli is terrible.
Yeah, who are only just the broccoli. All right, well, let's not gross everyone out. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.